I'm with the Department of Political Science, and it wouldn't be a climate science conference without talking about politics just a little bit, right? And I don't know how that makes you feel. I think a lot of people, when they hear the word politics and climate, get maybe a little bit anxious. But this is, I think, as we've heard from our previous speakers, absolutely a topic that we need to engage in all facets of the sciences and all facets of society. I don't know how many of you have ever seen this schematic or these drawings. This is from the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, and they've done research over the past decade or so, trying to segment Americans into these six groups. The six Americas is what they call this. And I'm gonna show you what the polling data is for the last couple of years and how it's changed. But I'm curious how all of you might kind of self-report or self-describe yourselves. And I think these terms are fairly, intuitive. I don't have to explain, you know, the difference between alarmed and dismissive. How many of you, just out of curiosity, are kind of somewhere in the middle there? You're cautious, disengaged. Show of hands, how many? Okay, just a couple. How many of you would consider yourselves alarmed or concerned? And how about for those of you, if you're comfortable telling us if you're dismissive or doubtful? Well, I think we're a very different demographic here than the United States. This is the survey data for the last couple of years, December of 2018 and November of 2016. And you can see that that demographic for the last, on the right side, the dismissive, doubtful, and disengaged, that 20%, 25% hasn't changed all that much. And that's been the case over the course of all of their sampling. But look at how the change that's taken place with those who are reporting, self-reporting, being alarmed. Seeing a big change there in the last 2 years. Now you can actually get online and take this test. They used to have 36 items on this survey to understand yourself or understand others. They've now pared it down to just 4 items that they ask. And you can categorize yourself on somewhere on this spectrum. So I'm gonna come back to some more of this data on the Yale Project on Climate Change Communications in just a few minutes. First of all, I wanna talk about what is community. And oftentimes we think about community as just the place that we live. We think of it as a geographic kind of jurisdictional or political boundary. And I'll be talking about community as in terms of place. But I'm also going to be talking about communities of interest. And I think all of us in this room, we could be described, kind of self-described as interested in this topic. So we're a community of interest. Communities are also identified, can be self-identified. So you can be a teacher or a student. You can be a Republican or a Democrat. And last, there are communities of practice. And I'll talk a little bit about that as well. The way I'm going to structure this is kind of the way that I'm doing a little bit of self-promotion here. This book just came out last month. It's a Routledge book. I'm the co-editor with a colleague from Utah State. And this is the way that we structured this book. So we talk about addressing climate change at the community level, and we talk about it in terms of these four categories. I'll just tell you a little bit about myself. You saw from my first slide, I'm a faculty member in the Department of Political Science, but I also have an extension appointment. And I'm one of about 30 faculty here on campus who are charged with traveling across the state and actually extending the resources of the university to the citizens. We do classes at low cost or at no cost across the state. We're one of a whole system of land-grant universities across the state, across the country. Across the state, you can see the distribution. We have approximately 90 what we call county agents. These are MSU faculty, they're professors that live in the counties. And we've been working actively with these faculty on a new climate science program in extension to try to, again, extend the resources, all the great research that you heard that Bruce does and others to the citizens of the state. We've developed all kinds of resources. We write them for the layperson. We write them for about the high school level You'll be hearing from Dr. Manalad in just a little while, who is the author of one of these publications. But we're really trying to target specific audiences, whether it's ag producers or others. Another audience that we've tried to reach, this is a publication that just came out 2 weeks ago. I authored this with some of my 4-H colleagues. 4-H is a youth development program. This is the first 4-H curricula for third, fourth, and fifth graders about climate change. And it's being reviewed right now at the national level by the National Council so that hopefully this can be distributed nationally so that kids at that age can learn about the difference between weather and climate. Let's talk now and shift gears and talk specifically about impacts to communities. And I'm going to cite some resources here, painting a picture about what communities can expect in the coming years. This is from the U.S. Global Change Research Program. The projected rapid rate and large amount of climate change over this century will challenge the ability of society and natural systems to adapt. The National Institutes of Health have stated climate change makes many existing diseases and conditions worse, but it may also help introduce new pests and pathogens into new regions and communities. The US EPA has stated climate change will affect certain groups more than others, particularly groups located in vulnerable areas and the poor, young, old, or sick. Oxfam has come out with a statement, current and future impacts of climate change on human society are and will continue to be overwhelmingly negative. And last, the Stern Review on the economics of climate change, what many see as the one of the most comprehensive economic reviews of climate change, has said that climate change threatens the basic elements of life for people around the world. The impacts of climate change are not evenly distributed. The poorest countries and people will suffer earliest and most. And we could go on and on and on with these studies. The impacts are projected to be overwhelmingly negative to society and affecting the most vulnerable individuals primarily first. So let's move into talking about communities of place here. Setting up that background about the impacts, I want to offer a little bit of positive or hopeful information to you. And this is an effort done by the Sierra Club. Sierra Club has about 3.5 million members, and their mission is self-described, defending everyone's right to a healthy world. And their Ready for 100 campaign, it was launched in 2016, and it's a national movement now to inspire leaders to embrace a vision of healthier communities powered by 100% clean, renewable energy by the year 2050. Currently, there's 120 cities, including Atlanta, Salt Lake City, San Diego, and now the largest, Chicago, that have formally adopted this ambitious 100% clean energy goal. And there are 6 cities in the United States that have already reached that goal, including my hometown of Burlington, Vermont. They've got a great website where you can access information about all of these campaigns. There are additional 215 mayors around the United States that have pledged their support for a community-wide transition to 100% renewable energy. And again, you can look at, find out information about contact information, et cetera, for all of those campaigns. The next community of place that I want to feature here is this effort called We Are Still In. And this is a commitment. It was started in June of 2017. It's been signed by over 3,500 organizations that are representatives of the United States economy and society. And what they're doing, they're standing by the Paris Agreement, the Paris Climate Agreement, and are committed to meeting its goals. So the signatories represent a constituency of about half of all Americans, and taken together, they represent about $9 trillion. And that's bigger than any nation other than the United States and China. You can see some of the numbers here. It includes businesses, mayors, governors, university presidents, faith leaders, tribal leaders, cultural institutions, everyone from Amazon to Microsoft, New York City to the state of California. It's a huge effort and a huge commitment that these organizations are making. I just want to feature now one other community of place. I could have picked so many examples. Copenhagen is a great example. It was a great article in the New York Times just recently describing their efforts in the next 6 years to be carbon neutral. In the next 6 years. So this is a city of 650,000 people that had been described as a grimy industrial city that is now well on its way to being carbon neutral and actually an exporter of energy. Lots of other examples around the world, and I encourage you to check those out. Let's talk about communities of identity now. And I'm going to reference the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And they've come out with a lot of information identifying certain populations that, as I had mentioned, as vulnerable. These vulnerable populations, of course, are going to be susceptible to extreme heat, severe weather, allergies, air pollution, all of the things that we associate with a changing climate. And I want to show you some of the statistics that were offered in the last National Climate Assessment. And these are some of the trends that we should be conscious of moving forward. We are an aging population here in the United States, and you can see over the course of the next 30 years, all of those baby boomers are going to be retiring. They're going to be living well into their 80s and 90s, and that's a vulnerable population. Asthma rates have been increasing over the last several decades. Chronic respiratory disease deaths, obesity rates in children and adolescents, diagnosed diabetes, poverty rates, et cetera, et cetera. You get the sense here. We've got a lot of vulnerable populations. Those populations are growing, and they're increasingly going to be impacted by climate change. All right, now let's talk about the politics. And there are not many other wedge issues that differentiate Republicans and Democrats than this issue. And you can see a 48-point spread between Republicans and Democrats on this question. Now, this Pew survey is a few years old, but more recent survey is similar to this. So when asked if global climate change is a very serious problem, you can see the spread between Republicans and Democrats. And in fact, I've been told by some of my political science colleagues that one of the primary predictors of determining if somebody is a Republican or a Democrat is asking them this question. Back to the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, and this is a great site if you want to, it's an interactive map where you can input different information. You can look at by congressional district or by county and different questions that have been asked. This question is, and this map is showing the estimated percentage of registered Democrats who think global warming is mostly caused by human activities. So for Democrats, that's just about 80%. Let's compare that with Republicans, 35% across the country. Again, I'll go back, Democrats, Republicans. Interesting spatial distribution of across the country as well. Why do we have this difference between Republicans and Democrats? Particularly when we had folks like John McCain and even George Bush talking years ago about the need to address this issue. Well, this could be a whole separate lecture, I think, talking about this. But a lot of this is summed up in Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway's book, where they look at the history of misinformation that's propagated by industry around the tobacco issue and relate that to this current issue of climate change. And of course, we're not getting a lot of news coverage about this topic. This is a little bit dated, but you can see over the course of the last 10 years, these are the number of minutes annually that broadcast news coverage is discussing climate change. So in 2016, in election year, there were 11 minutes over the course of that year on the Sunday shows and 39 minutes for ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox for the nightly news. And you can see that breakdown by network. So we're just not getting a lot of that. And I think this is the way a lot of mainstream America receives their information. All right, let's shift now to communities of interest. And I think some of you are familiar about the press that some of these groups have been receiving. The Sunrise Movement, it's an American youth-led political movement. And they're advocating for political action on climate change. The group organized sit-ins in Speaker Pelosi's office. And if any of you saw the recent exchange that was caught on video with Dianne Feinstein in her office, These folks are stepping up and taking some really, I think, some very serious risks. They're also skipping school and doing things like school strikes for climate. They're also known as Fridays for Future, Youth for Climate, and Youth Strike for Climate. This is a global movement, an international movement of school students that are deciding not to attend classes and instead taking part in demonstrations and demanding action on climate change. And you may recognize that face in the upper right corner. That's Greta Thunberg from Sweden, who stood by herself outside of the Swedish parliament and has now been a speaker to MPs in the UK, to the EU. Probably one of the most articulate 16-year-olds that you'll see speak about climate change. The last thing I'll talk about in terms of communities of interest is this case, Giuliana v. the United States. It's a lawsuit that was filed in 2015. It's being brought by 21 youth plaintiffs, Giuliana being the last name of one of the plaintiffs, against the United States. The lawsuit asserts that government violation of youth rights, that the government is violating youth rights by encouraging and allowing activities that significantly harm their right to life and liberty. And in 2016, the U.S. District Court in Oregon upheld that idea that access to a clean environment was a fundamental right, but the government has sought to dismiss this case. And it's currently the upcoming trial is on hold pending some depositions. You're probably familiar also with the Extinction Rebellion movement, the People's Climate Movement, involving literally hundreds of thousands of people around the world. The last thing I want to talk to you about are communities of practice. And I want to talk specifically about this new SRI movement and divestment movement that we're seeing across the country and around the world. SRI is sustainable or sustainably responsible investing, or ESG stands for environmental, social, and corporate governance. So these terms are used interchangeably. And you can see the rapid expanse of investment now in ESG or SRI funds. The total U.S. Assets under management now using SRI strategies grew from $8.7 trillion at the start of 2016 to $12 trillion at the start of 2018. That's in 2 years. So that's almost a 40% increase in 2 years. And this is not a fad. This is not going away. We're going to see this continue. So this represents 26% of total investment of the total investment of professionally managed assets in the United States. Now, these SRIs include not just fossil fuels, but they also include workers' rights, child labor, environmental degradation, those kinds of things, governance on boards. But let's talk specifically about the divestment movement away from fossil fuels. So divestment is the opposite of investment. It simply means getting rid of, your stocks, your bonds, your investment funds, or reinvesting them in ways that you feel are more ethical. And so now many people feel that fossil fuels are not just bad for the planet, but a bad personal risk for their own personal portfolios. And that's why they're calling on institutions to divest from certain companies. There's a lot of organizations that are tracking this and promoting this. This is Go Fossil Free. 350.org is another organization you might be familiar with. And they're promoting, according to their figures, there are over 1,000 institutions, including New York City and the country of Ireland, that have totally divested from fossil fuels. This divestment is nearly $9 trillion. It's nearly the GDP, half the GDP of the United States. And there are additional 58,000 individuals around the world now that are personally divesting. And that accounts to $5 billion, including as of last week myself. So let's ask this question. In your community of place, your community of interest, your community of identity or practice, what can you do? What power do you have as an individual?